Welcome to the Software People Stories. I'm Shiv.
I'm Chitra.
And I'm Gayatri.
We bring you interesting untold stories of people
associated with the creation
or consumption of software-based solutions.
You'll hear stories of what worked
and sometimes what didn't.
You'll also hear very personal experiences
and insights that would trigger your thoughts
and inspire you to do even greater things.
A chance to speak to a voice coach whose class I had taken a few years ago seemed exciting. When Shivguru, my co-host on the Software People Stories podcast, introduced us over email, I said, hey, here's a chance to ask Malini, our guest today, so many questions. We talk about how to manage different careers and hold our identities across each one of them, from software to travel to voiceovers and poetry writing. Malini shares her perspectives on quality software, understanding customer needs, and why software building goes beyond the transactional. She shares with us her plunge into the world of content, media, and curating travel experiences after a terrible incident that shook our nation. Celebrating Women's Day, as we have on the Software People Stories, listen to this episode through Malini and my conversation that spans topics on empowering people through language in software development, to how she helps create the feeling of safety when curating travel by establishing local connections when she travels.
So good morning, Malini, and a very warm welcome to you to the Software People Stories podcast. Great to have you on this show. Someone as interesting as yourself, and with that, no pressure. But I hand over the mic to you to introduce yourself to our listeners.
All right. Good morning, Chitra. Thank you so much for having me on Software People Stories. I'm very glad to be here. And I think the work that you do with Software People Stories is amazing. I went through a few of the episodes and it's very insightful, I must say. So I'm very glad to be here. So to introduce myself, I am Malini Gaurishankar. I started off with software, being in software industry as a developer, and then moved on to media industry as a voiceover artist and a radio jockey, and then moved on to start my own travel company, which specializes in women travel, especially with India as a destination. And then now I'm at a phase of my career, in the 20th year of my career, that I'm across all these three industries. I do paid voiceovers as a hobby. I consult in a software organization. And in the mornings, I run my travel company. So that's where I am. So my life is intertwined with software and the learnings have been applied in other industries as well. I'm very glad to be able to be presented with an opportunity to share those learnings.
This is fantastic on several levels. And as we unravel, unbox, and unpack your journey, I'm really interested and curious to understand how this all came to be. So did you always know that you were going to sort of do engineering and become a software engineer first?
Absolutely not. Having said that, being the nerdy first bencher student, I knew I wanted to go somewhere all the nerds go. So the top choice in my generation, and I think it continues to be, was IT industry. And the easiest foot in the door to IT was engineering. So, and also, a decently well-paying start to your career is also in IT. That came to be in my generation. Probably a generation before me, but yeah. Approximately, I'm talking about mid-2000s. And actually, it's very interesting how I chose software. I did get into engineering. I came out with good grades. I did have my first software offer from Polaris Software in Chennai. At the same time, the media side of me, I've always been continuously in the media limelight in terms of participating in reality shows for music and performing in All India Radio with my poetry and Carnatic music in to All India Radio Chennai and various Tamil TV channels as well. So there was that side that was very interested in going through that career. So I applied, I did a screen test with Doordarshan Chennai, interestingly, at the same time. So when I came out of engineering, I had two offers in hand. One to start off as an anchor in Doordarshan Chennai, and the other one was a developer at Polaris Software Labs. It's no surprise which one I chose. I chose to be a developer at Polaris. Because okay. I studied engineering, I must be doing that and the salary is good. Yeah, that's how I got to be in software industry. And I must say I enjoy it. Till date, whatever I do in the software industry, I definitely enjoy it.
It's very nice to know. So let's look at, you know, take a slight deviation onto that path first. With respect to your software engineering experience, what have been some of the moments that have stood out to you in terms of, let's say, key learning moments that you can share with us?
Sure. As I said, in my first job, the initial few months, I was in support. Suddenly, there is this student. You put her into supporting one of the biggest banks in the world. I mean, supporting in terms of resolving backend issues, the software issues of it, not frontline support. So that was overwhelming to begin with. But I think it gave me the learning of how important it is to develop good software for a business. And, you know, a lot of I know quite a few people who are passionate about software. And they love coding or they love solving problems. But the biggest perspective that I learned right from the beginning is software is made for companies, for business. They serve a business purpose and they add value to a particular business. And it's imperative that we deliver good, high quality software for our customers, so that they realize the business value of it. It's not just a mere transaction. That is something that I learned right in the beginning. And I keep it as my fundamental learning and ethic, work ethic when I'm in the software industry. Actually, not just software, any service for that matter. I've been in the software service industry, not in the product side. So any service that we deliver, we need to keep the business purpose and the value in mind. Always. That has been the most important learning for me.
That's very very good to know and nice to hear it all the time. And these are, I think, a set of, I would almost call them principles that I think anybody in the software industry needs to keep in mind, whether you're a developer or any part of the entire software creation and delivery process, isn't it?
Yes, yes. One thing that I noticed when I just entered the industry, especially being a part of a huge company, it was not just Polaris, I was a part of a few other companies, huge MNCs as well. One thing that I noticed was the disconnect between those who are developing software on the ground versus those who are getting the requirements. Now design, user journey, all these things have come to be in a big way. Even then, in a lot of huge organizations, they get lost in the hierarchy. That is something that I think we need to constantly keep bridging. Now, we as leaders in the industry, we need to keep constantly bridging that so that every single person is not just delivering their piece of work. Even the junior most person in the team is not just developing and, you know, producing work, but they take pride in what they deliver because this is the business value that was realized. Probably, you know, the boost to the bottom line or, you know, the top line, or it has made clients' life so much easier. One thing that I see that does not happen is the feedback loop of what is the happy moment for the customer through this delivery. That does not happen even now in very big organizations. In smaller organizations, that visibility is there. But in big organizations, somewhere it gets lost down the hierarchy. That is something that I'm very, I look forward to changing. I mean, to not personally me, but in general, I would like to see this change come about in most of the organizations.
Let's dwell a little bit upon that, because, you know, back, most of my experience has been with product companies, and there was almost a practice sort of in any company that I worked in that, you know, when you started out as a developer or an engineer at any level in the company, the first thing you did was to actually read the defects that were reported by customers and sort of get together and as a team or as a set of developers coming together, you looked at them. You tried to understand the language of the customer, right? And I bring in language purposefully because when you are developing something, the language that you use is very different. But when customers report issues, there are differences in their language as well. Because that's more coming from a usage perspective, something that's impacted their daily life.
Yes.
And, you know, it's a serious matter. How do you understand that? And then we would be encouraged to listen to voice of customer, where our customer success teams would be in conversation with customers. So I had thought that that was a solved problem. And you seem to have a different perspective. Would you like to sort of elaborate a little more on that?
Sure. So that's where I think the product versus services thing also comes in, right? So a software product is generally designed to solve a very specific customer problem. It is not just, you know, for one customer. Okay, what this customer is going through this problem at this point in time, we are solving that. We come in, we deliver, and we go out. That's typically how a service happens. Whereas in product, it has a much, much longer life cycle. So you,
you somewhat attract a customer. Sense of continuity with a certain set of customers. You're more connected with them. Is that something?
It does happen in product, especially when the customer has the buy-in into the product. You have a captive customer who will keep unless you get a better, you get your product act together, they are going to switch to another product. Right? So the user journey perspective, the workflows, understanding the business use case and the feedback loop, I think happens a lot more. The emphasis is laid a lot more in the product domain than in the service domain. In the service domain, they have a very specific requirement at a point in time. And you go in, you resolve that problem for them. And a lot of time, it's a time-based project as well. So a lot of time, you may not have time to completely get all everybody's buy-in. I mean, even in the, not buy-in, not you may not have the time to educate the entire team on the entire requirement. So sometimes somewhere due to delivery pressures, right? Whereas in product, there is a very well-defined life cycle. You are generating a set of features. It is out there with the customer. You have a lot of customer feedback coming in for the next version of the product or bug fixes of the product, which goes into the next release. It's a very well-defined life cycle. That's where I think with product, in general, people are much more aware of what is going on with the user. But in the service industry, a lot of times it stops at the, especially in a very hierarchical organization, the pressure to deliver, the pressure to deliver exactly right, stops at the manager, and it comes down purely as pressure and not more as user inputs. Yeah. It's something that I have observed. I may not be...
No, it's an interesting perspective. And, you know, a couple of things. While, yes, there appears to be a sense that in product companies, everything is so nicely defined, is so well connected. There are those moments as well.
Yes. But take it with a bottle of salt.
No, not that. I think the question I was coming to, Marlene, in a lot of these, we all understand that, you know, the pressure to deliver revenues for the company that's working on it, all, everything is on the line, so to speak. And what I sort of sensed in the last couple of minutes of our conversation is, you know, the importance of understanding the why of what we do, right? And somewhere that gets missed along the way. And I feel that is such an essential thing to build a connect with, you know, whether it's, you know, any person in the organization, just understanding the why, even if it's a one-line requirement, and I have to get this done in the next 3 days. Why am I doing it? Isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. There are two aspects to that why. One, to understand if I represent a particular software organization, why are we working with this customer? Does it align with our values? As this company, as a part of this company, am I representing my company correctly? That is the first why. The second why is the client wanting to solve this particular problem? What does it mean to my client? And how can I deliver my best there? There are both of these aspects. And I think it comes out really well in smaller organizations. I've been a part of bigger MNCs and small organizations in the service sector. The current one that I consult with, it's called Sahaj. So there this is a small service company, software services company, where we work in smaller teams. We work with specific clients, and the company also has a very strong, ethics, code of ethics, and the way we operate and all of that. Here I see a very different world, how you can effectively deliver software when you keep your client's vision in mind and your own code of ethics in mind. So yeah, it's the why is very important.
Yeah, and it was interesting the way it came out in this conversation. One thing is, I noticed that many people struggle to ask the right question, you know, at the right time. I won't qualify by saying the right question, because I don't think any question is right or wrong, or, you know, not good enough or good enough or whatever it is. But I think the important thing is to encourage everybody to ask questions. If you didn't understand something, say, hey, I don't know why they're asking for this. Why do we have to do it this way? Why is it only this way? And stuff like that. And recently, you know, I was listening to some people talking to a group of students where concerns were being voiced already about AI taking away jobs and so on. So at that point in time, somebody put a very beautiful point across and said, it's more our power and our ability to navigate the AI world will lie in our ability to ask questions,
yes,
rather than, taking things for granted. So I was just thinking, maybe in such a situation, how do we encourage people to ask more questions about the work that they do, whether any kind of company, small, big, services, products?
Yeah. Asking questions happens when the curiosity is kept alive in a person. irrespective of software or whichever other industry. How do we keep the curiosity in our people alive? That's where comes the people factor of software also, right? Where building software is not a transaction, but okay, what can I learn from this? For that, the leaders should lead by example. They continue staying curious about the why of softwares and encourage people to ask those questions, mentor the youngsters in the team to, if they are doing something, what more they can do or what more questions they can ask, challenge me. It should not be a one-way street where somebody who is senior is giving work rather than doing that. Okay, this is what we are planning to achieve. What do you think? How would you go about it? Then automatically, the youngsters in the team are bestowed with a sense of power and confidence. I'm not subservient here. I can also actually contribute to ideation. And that's where you're kindling the curiosity. Okay, now that I am also equally responsible for this delivery, what all can I now bring to the table? For that, I need to ask questions. Basically, empowering every single person in the team is where it lies, I think. Otherwise, the curiosity dies after a point when you are constantly given work and not asked to pick up work.
Beautifully put, Malini. I love the way the last couple of minutes just happened in terms of, looking at the space. We started out with, the disconnect between what customers really want versus how people who are responsible for developing it don't really see it and see where we've landed up with actually empowering people. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Just like the way this whole conversation happened.
I wanted to add something at this point. This is something that I very strongly feel about software, because I was one of those people who quit software industry a decade ago. I quit as a developer and I came back more as a project. My role is in the current company is called Enabler. I work part-time in this company. I enable people and processes and client relationships. That's my current role in this company. And I'm generally told that, people burn out and get out of software. They don't come back. It has a very bad reputation, which needs to be taken away. I've also been on the other side, right? So hence, I want to bring this up in good organizations, in, non-exploitative organizations. Definitely, there is still this possibility of keeping the curiosity alive and ensuring that software industry is a very, very impactful industry. Whatever we see, the systems around and the products around that we see, the entire internet is powered by wonderful software. I think we need to give that credit where it is due and not demonize it as, I cannot work beyond this point. I want to take a retirement. Because I'm also a part of the travel industry where I see customers who are overworked IT people. I think the work ethics and the way people are treated as people and not just as resources, if that change comes by, people will really start looking at software industry as a hotspot of learning and not just of making money.
Yeah,
okay, software is one of the highest paying ones. It's not just that reputation. It's a hotbed of curiosity and learning. So I think
I really like that, the hotbed of curiosity and learning. And I think if we, looked at everything that way, life would be so different. And I love the fact that you have you listening to this, so it goes back to, part of what we do in user research is what are people thinking? thinking, feeling, listening to, and doing, right? And I really hope that, you know, our listeners take to heart what you say with respect to being curious, learning, and also for organizations and leaders, there's a very powerful message that you have, you know, put forth, saying that how do we create those environments for people to be able to freely express themselves, probably unlock their latent curiosity. All of us are curious, we're human beings, and make such a difference. Nicely said, Mani.
Yeah, absolutely. And this perspective also comes from the point that in the current organization that I consult with, which is Sahaj, it was born out of the need to reduce exploitation in IT. So I see how empowering people can work. I'm seeing that in reality, and I feel empowered and happy to work with this brand. That's exactly why I think this is absolutely doable. It's
fantastic.
Not just a pipe dream.
Fantastic. I think this is a good message to go out even for people who are looking to start companies. It's a very powerful message that I see even for founders, entrepreneurs in this particular space, for that matter, in any space. I think if, I mean, personally for me, I always think that, you know, a size of a company shouldn't matter, or the, you know, should not only be driven with revenue and, you know, things like that, which have been traditionally the hallmarks of a company's success. But how is it that you can nurture multiple small units or environments like this that really, you know, it's sort of a mutual nurturing, if I may say so.
Yeah, yeah.
Between the employees
yeah.
and the employers as well, right? With the
yeah.
common goal of keeping the customer in mind first.
Exactly. And also empowering language helps, where empowering language and processes both help. For example, referring to people as people
yeah.
and not resources.
Thank you for bringing
yes.
that up. In fact, I had wanted to say that and forgot. I really appreciate and admire that. You know, resources is such a machine-like word.
Yeah.
I think that's
ultimately we
important.
Have to bill.
Yeah.
Ultimately, we have to bill, but
yes.
You can bill with people's time, not resources. So that empowering language would help, and also connecting the team with the customer early, right from the as early as possible in the process, will also help. You know, the need to fulfill the requirement to fulfill a customer's need does not lie only in the leadership in that team, but the entire we are responsible. Okay, I as a manager is responsible for handling the client, and I bring back this work to you. Rather than that, any place where we remove the I and put a we there, the team suddenly feels included. That these are very empowering processes that can benefit any team, irrespective of the industry it is in. One more anecdote. I just remembered this. You can add it wherever you want, Chitra. I was talking about how IT needs to be empowering and all of that, and people should not be burning out, right? So on my travel industry side, our company, we used to run a series of events called Just Go, encouraging people to travel. One of the topics in that became the most popular across 6 different cities in India was, don't quit your job to travel. There was this phase where people were quitting their jobs, most of them from IT. Oh, I want to just travel. So we were trying to put in this message that you don't necessarily have to quit what you're doing to be able to travel. You can do both of it, both of these things. You can pursue. Primarily the message was, you keep your passions along with your work, and that's when you'll be able to sustain. Even in IT, when you are focusing on your well-being, you'll do much more, you'll do better at your work. That was the message. And I think that message is extremely important, especially in the software industry, because you can get carried away by delivery pressures and, you know, various factors that exist. So it's extremely important as an individual to bring the best to your work, and to be able to do that, you need to take care of your personal side of your life as well.
Thank you for bringing that to light. This conversation is becoming more and more enjoyable. I must say that a lot of what you have said are personally shared values for me. And I really hope that you know, we could nurture these in the places where we are working. I have also personally tried to, you know, bring about a lot of that wherever I've worked, because it's important, right? We, even as human beings personally, we need to sustain. It's about sustainability, being well, being energetic, and also having having that enthusiasm, curiosity,
yeah,
to bring your best to wherever you are. And it needs a mix of both. You can't just keep, you know, 14, 15 hours a day just trying to, you know, bring something out without having all these aspects incorporated. So definitely appreciate that point. And so now with all of these experiences, when was the first time an aha moment or a pin drop moment for you when you veered into the creative space with respect to content, media, writing? How did all that happen the first time you sort of moved from software to doing these things?
As I already mentioned, I always had an academic side to me and a creative side to me. I was brought up that way, always pursuing music and poetry all through my childhood and teens, and then getting into software industry. At the same time, I was academically well, good, decently good as well. So I had these two identities inside me, and I always wanted to satisfy both, you know, keep both of these identities intact. That was always there. So the first 2 or 3 years of my being in software, I was fully focused on only doing that. And that's when I realized I cannot thrive like that. I can survive, but I will not be able to thrive like that, because I constantly needed a creative vent. And I was used to being behind the mic, and I needed that. Being behind the mic is my thing. So either I should be singing or talking or reading out poetry. So that's when I decided to participate in a reality show again. By the time I was married, and I was pregnant as well. So I found a studio in Bangalore. I was working in Bangalore at that time. I was with Oracle. And I went to a studio to record my voice for a reality show. This was back in 2006. And at that point, that person said, we have an animation series of CD-ROMs. Would you like to provide your voice to one of the characters? It's like, wow, I didn't know this existed. This is interesting. At that point, I realized I loved voice acting as well. So I've been a part of theater in school and all of that. Okay, there is this side that I can pursue. Then that's when I did my first voiceover. And then I continued pursuing that side by side as a weekend hobby while I was still in IT. And then I also started taking up script writing for these voiceover scripts that were required, small television commercials and radio ads and all of that. So which would require very little work. The scripts would be very small, but they required the creative thinking. So it would take minimal time. I set up a small home studio. I started pursuing this over the weekends while I was still in IT. And in 2011 was when I took the plunge and decided to quit IT industry to see what are the possibilities in this side of the industry. Because till then it was just a paid hobby. I wanted to see if it is possible to actually sustain myself doing what I loved doing, being in the creative space. So that's when I became a radio jockey. And then I started taking up more writing assignments, content, and all of these. But I also happened to do voiceovers for IT companies, their e-learning programs. That's when it started becoming a spaghetti. All the three industries that I have been a part of, they started coming together at around 2015-16. By 2013, I had ventured into starting my travel company because that was I gave up whatever I was doing to start this travel company because in 2012, the Nirbhaya rape happened. And I wanted, one thing that was very clear in my head is impact. Whatever I do, there has to be an impact. This was realized even in software industry, because the first, in the third and fourth year of my IT career, I was back to back writing software for social impact. I was in the microfinance domain. I was writing software in the microfinance domain, and I could see how the work I was doing would impact a farmer sitting somewhere in Africa by a cow or a goat. That's when, in fact, software was what put the idea in me that you can actually do what you are doing, make money, and also make some form of social impact. So that lesson from software industry I carried along. So it has now come a full circle where I am back in software trying to do impactful stuff. But again, the curiosity and continuously wanting to learn is what is pushing my pursuits from all these different perspectives and help me gain all these perspectives continuously. That's what is motivating me even now. I can see the world. So
it's your own little continuous feedback mechanism that's happening.
Absolutely.
Helping you to do different things.
Absolutely. The perspective is tremendous, where on one side I'm working with my peers in the IT industry, delivering software. And on the other side, I'm running a travel company where these people, when they are not at work, they want to spend their time doing things that they are passionate about or seeing the world. It's such an incredible space to be in. And I'm very, very grateful for all the opportunities that have come my way. And I'm genuinely thankful to all my mentors who have handheld me till date. I still have a mentor from the software industry for the past decade or so, who has also held my hand through my entrepreneurial journey. He would give me a perspective that I wouldn't think about. And I have mentors from the entrepreneurial space also, who give me perspectives into my job and my business, all of these. So I'm very grateful.
That's awesome, Malini. So from your travel realm, what have been some really memorable, let's say, either places or moments? I know you have referenced, made a lot of references to what people have shared with you. Based on, you know, why they're traveling and why they need this and so on. But what have been some of the other really standout moments for you in terms of, let's say, the places you visited and, things that have happened there?
There have been a lot. The first time when I went to Sikkim, and that was the first time I was going to the Northeast. No, actually, the second time I was going to the Northeast, I realized how beautiful that part of the country is, and how safe I felt in Sikkim or in Meghalaya. And this was back in 2012 and 13, when travel was still not this prevalent in that world. And me having been to these places as a solo traveler was wanting to scream from the rooftop saying, India is not unsafe. Don't bucket it as, you know, one crazy unsafe destination. So that's where the rage to prove the world wrong, especially after that Nirbhaya situation happened, came from. It was from my travels. It had a very important impact in my career, where it went into travel. That was because of my own travels and experiencing India as a destination, where there are amazing people everywhere who will make you feel safe. And that's what I wanted to give to the world, or the, you know, the women travelers in India as a service. Me, along with my co-founder Akanksha, have been doing that for the past 11 years. And when and we have had women who come back to us and tell us, okay, I'm taking my first leap traveling without family with you guys. Hope I feel safe. And they come with some people are seasoned travelers, and some of them are first timers who are trying this for the first time. And many people have come back to us and told us how transformative this has been for them. And those are all incredible moments where we travel through them, and we travel and all the travels we have done in the past feel so validated when we are able to, when our personal life experiences have been able to help somebody else feel safe and travel happily in India.
Absolutely, a very, very powerful statement to make, and in some sense even help people get over their fears. And this is an interesting segue to a very different part of the conversation. Like you said, you know, the question of how safe that space is for women traveling in India, that question is at the forefront of many who
absolutely,
who embark on it. So how do you actually, you know, help people face those fears?
Let me start with a disclaimer. No one can promise anyone safety. That's what we say too as a business. But at the same time, we'll ensure we can do everything in our capacity to make you feel safe, because safety is an emotion. I feel safe in a place. How do we do that? We work with the locals primarily. We make local connections. And for example, if once we know a property in a particular place, we map all the related activities and services from that person. You know, every local will have a trusted network, right? For example, if we know the local royalty in that region, they will know trusted vendors, drivers. You know, that's how over the past decade we have mapped out entire India. And then we do women group tours. Group tours, there is an inherent feeling of safety when you travel in groups. That's the second aspect. And if you are traveling solo, if a woman is taking the first step to completely travel solo, where there is no tour manager from our end and she wants to explore on her own, that is also something that we enable by ensuring trusted vendors, trusted guides, and we are also available on call when she is when she needs some help. That way, and at the same time, we also educate people on the local sensibilities, the cultural sensibilities, and all those aspects. For example, if you are in a temple, you are supposed to be dressed in a particular way, any place of worship. And it's important to respect those local traditions that exist. adhere to the cultural sensibilities of the region. So we educate our customers on these aspects before they even go to a destination. So when the local people feel respected, they will in fact even stand up for you. When they see you getting harassed or, you know, feeling unsafe, they will stand up for you. So that's one of the important aspects of respecting where the locals, wherever you go. So these are all things that we educate and empower women with when they travel with us. Now, there are many women groups. A lot of them are traveling in India. But in 2013, women traveling in India was still very, very nascent and almost unheard of. So I'm very glad we could bring about a change at that point, which now the industry looks much better, and the women are also feeling much more empowered. And in general, it's a much better time to be in. At the same time, women must always exercise caution, or anybody for that matter. We need to always be mindful of where we are, the surroundings, and we need to ensure we keep ourselves safe as well. Things can happen anywhere. So mindful travel is key.
Nice way to put it, Malini. Recently, I have been, following a lot of reports about women in the workforce and the labor force participation in India. And when I mean labor force, it could be of any kind across the board. The numbers are not very encouraging. In fact, over the last 40, 50 years, they seem to be declining. While there are small blips, I think very recently, perhaps 2 weeks ago, I just read that maybe it went up from 24% to 26% in the past year and a half. But overall, it doesn't seem encouraging at all. There is something that's happening, not sure what it is. But my sense tells me that safety is a big part of that decision to continue working. There are other parameters as well. What in your points of view have been some of your defining moments that you feel you could share with other women to help women, let's say, stay in the workforce, as well as encourage younger women to actively participate and sustain in their careers?
I think there are multiple factors at play, but a very quick point of reference from my own career, early stages of career. I got married very early in my career, and there was a particular manager who said, who wouldn't assign work to me because, oh, you're just married, or, you'll be distracted, something like that. I felt really, really hurt. I hope that we have come a very long way from there. This was in 2004, but I think such people wouldn't dare say such things out loud in this day and age, because this can constitute harassment at workplace, that you are not assigned work because you are of a specific gender, or you're going through a specific phase in life, especially, a marriage, or I will not assign work to you. If a person is going on a, if a person is having some kind of an injury, or, there is a health issue, then it makes sense to encourage them, not burden them with work. You take your sabbatical, you recover, and you come back is a very different thing. But because a person is of a particular gender, assuming that that person will not contribute the way they would, is one of the very bad experiences that I carry till date after 19 years of work. And that has made me much more mindful as to how I educate people in my workplace to not do something like that. And I would never do something like that based on any gender or any kind of discrimination for that matter. So that is one If anything like this happens, if there are any passive aggressive signs of something like this happen, women do feel insecure and underconfident at the workplace. So my message to the women who are hearing this podcast is, it's not your doing. You be loyal to your work and you deliver what is expected of you, or even over and above that if you want to do so. If you're very passionate about your work, you focus and be mindful of what you are delivering at your workplace. And if somebody is crossing those boundaries, feel free to report it to your... I'm sure all organizations must have this anti-harassment cell, or somebody... There are also these mentorship programs, buddy programs that are in place in several organizations, which provide the necessary support system for all employees to be able to voice out concerns. Make really good use of these aspects. But at the same time, ensure you bring the best of yourself to work as well. So both aspects. So that is something that I would say to... So when you bring the best of yourself, or, you know, perform at your... If 80% is your standard, ensure that you are staying at your 80%, you are giving at your 80% or aiming for 100%. And when you are challenged around that, stand up for yourself. Don't let any kind of discrimination come and rob yourself of your confidence and your security.
Yeah, I think that's
workplace.
Very nicely said, Malini. And I think there's, again, a very powerful message to leave many of our listeners with. I think both, anyone, I think, can take these away.
That said, just one more aspect there, especially because I'm very passionate about this aspect, because I'm called the enabler in my current organization, I do work closely with women. When I find signs that they might be overwhelmed, and women are still the primary caregivers in a household. Till this day and age, in across generations, that is still the case, where there is very minimal family support or support from the spouse, and the woman is expected to rise up to be a superwoman and do it all. So at those times, from my end as a compassionate, not manager, I wouldn't say, a compassionate enabler, I hear them out and I keep looking out for signs of fatigue in women, and in general signs of fatigue from everybody, irrespective of gender or age or race or culture, irrespective of anything. So with, you know, with everyone, I generally say, set your boundaries at work. If you are perennially available, you'll be expected to be available all the time. You know, you're always available. So this is something that I tell everybody. With women, I do tell them, you know, don't beat yourself up. And if you are feeling fatigued or overwhelmed, talk to somebody. So I try and be there for people who are showing signs of initial signs of burnout or overwhelmed feeling or fatigue and all of that, and I try to talk to them. I might not always be able to capture these signs because I work in a permanently remote setup, so there are only a few things that I can do, but I try and set up conversations with people, especially when people are going through life changes, be it a man or a woman, when they are having a baby, or when they are, we do tell them, you know, you be there for your family, take the vacations, take the paternity that you need, please be there for your family, you can come back, we'll figure out. The world is not going to come down if you, you know, that's also another thing that I see, okay, if there is a pattern there, when one of my male colleagues get married, you know, probably they are expected to come back in a week or so. This is, it's not set expectation, but I generally see that. They don't take their time out as well. So there is somewhere inherently there that we are not talking about. We, you know, there is a sense of a provider that is still reinforced somewhere in men. They carry that pressure. And there is a sense of a caregiver in women that is being carried. That's the cross is being carried over to this generation also. And it's a slightly more empowered workplace, but we have miles to go.
I'm glad you brought this up. I think in the context of inclusivity, it's a very strong recognition of that fact. And in fact, I'm very tempted to say, why should both bear the burden? You know, why do you carry that cross on yourself, right?
I wish
there are more spaces to hold such conversations, and you know, help people see for themselves that there is a lot more in to work and life in general. And also, like you know, just wanted to circle back to what you said initially. How can people become enablers for each other, or enablers for people around them as well? You know, first start with yourself, then with yourself, if you are in a relationship with your partner, and then extend it to your work, your community around you. I think if all of us can do a little bit to ease these burdens that we carry, having inherited them through, you know, thousands of years of conditioning and society's influences. I'm not saying they're good or bad, but in a way that can be more enabling and empowering. I think that would make for a lot of, you know, happier places.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Happier homes and happier workplaces.
Yes. Yes. And I think on that note, Malini, thank you so much. This has been a very, very inspiring and invigorating podcast, at least for me. And I hope you felt the same as well.
Thank you so much, Chitra. I feel very grateful for being on this podcast. I look up to you and Shiva, who has been a mentor to me as well in the past. I'm very thankful to Software People Stories for having me.
Thank you so much.
We thank Siddharth for the music and Anita for promoting the Software People Stories.
If you like this episode,
please subscribe on your favorite podcast client
and spread the word in your network.
If you'd like to share your story,
contact us at podcasts@pm-powerconsulting.com.